Hello, my name is Krzysztof Pietroszek. I'm a founding director of the Institute for Ideas. I have two guests today, Melissa Hawkins and John Bratt, who are working on a very interesting research related to COVID. So, Melissa, how is your situation in the COVID and what are you working on right now?
Public health has been at the center of this current and evolving crisis, rightfully so. And in many ways, as Dr. Anthony Fauci just said when he spoke to AU last week, this is a moment in public health. So my work is in public health and in epidemiology, and along with the other faculty in our department, much of our work revolves around improving health equity here in DC and across the country, and specifically how social determinants of health impact health. So that is, you know, social factors that are basic determinants in the distribution of many diseases in terms of susceptibility, in terms of exposure, in terms of health outcomes, all of which are disproportionately impacting people of color during this pandemic and are being exacerbated by this pandemic. So this work is really relevant now. There's so much we don't know and there's so much we have to learn, but this pandemic has really shown a light on something that we've known for a long time, that social factors impact health. So the work that I'm really focusing on now and that I've pivoted to focus on right now with the pandemic really involves food security and food access. A main project is looking at children and in wards 7 and 8 in DC and their access to affordable, nutritious food, especially with schools being closed. I'm also a truck fellow for the AU Humanities truck this year. And so for that project, we're going to be examining the impact of food insecurity and food challenges and DC residents from their perspective outside of corner stores, because DC is a food desert. Many in Ward 7 and 8, it's a food desert. And then we have a project that's looking at community health workers. And so community health workers are sort of liaisons between the community and the healthcare or the medical system. They're usually members of the community. And so we're looking at how community health workers can play a role and are playing a role, particularly around increasing access to food and helping to manage chronic diseases during this time.
So this is this looks like a lot of very important projects, especially during the pandemic. You mentioned at the beginning, which people might or might not be aware of, the disparities in how COVID affects different populations. What is exactly happening? What are exactly the factors and what are the differences and where they are coming from?
Sure. So COVID-19 is reminding us that health is local and that health is interconnected. The data that we're seeing is painting a very clear picture of how the pandemic is taking a disproportionate toll on certain communities. So Black and Latino individuals are three times more likely to be infected by SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, are twice as likely to die from COVID-19 as white individuals. Native Americans and Asians are also disproportionately affected. And in fact, most recently, Hispanic Americans were the only racial group to see an increase in COVID deaths over the summer, where it basically plateaued. And it's important to note that these racial and ethnicity data are very incomplete. So this race and ethnicity information is missing from over more than half the cases in the US, and still we're seeing these really striking disparities. And so, you know, what's really important to note when we're looking at these differences is that, you know, are these differences due to genetics or some physiological difference? And the research is clear that there's no biological component, you know, now or in other ways that we look at health outcomes and health disparities. Disparities are the results of social determinants of health, the kind of work that we examine, and that makes certain communities more vulnerable.
What are specific causes? When you say social disparities, can you give us an example? What is the difference? Is like access to the good quality hospital, or maybe in terms of the infection itself, the types of jobs? What are the exact specific?
Yeah, so, you know, these can be disparities mostly in terms of your environment, where you live, where you work, and your access, as you mentioned, to care. And so, you know, we know that certain workers who do not have the ability to have jobs that you can do from home are going to be more at risk because of their exposure. So they're out more and they have a greater exposure. We also know that people who have other chronic conditions or other illnesses are at greater risk. So, you know, many racial and ethnic minorities work in essential jobs. So that puts them at greater risk of transmission risk. It also tends to impact women of color more. And racial and ethnic minorities are more, are disproportionately affected by comorbidities. So this is also puts them at greater risk. And this is certainly the case in DC, where many residents have more than one chronic health condition.
And what are the causes of this comorbidities being different between different populations? Is there any explanation of that? Like it's a result of a type of work, or is there an, are there any explanations?
Yeah, no, that's a million dollar, that's a million dollar question. So, you know, a short answer is that a lot of times chronic conditions are preventable conditions or conditions that can be managed well if they're caught early. But if there's delay in care, or if there's delay in access, if there's if there's lack of insurance, then these conditions can progress much quickly and become much more severe. Certainly we see this with diabetes and other conditions, that they become much more severe conditions that could have either been prevented or managed better if there was earlier access to care.
And your specific work focuses on food, as you said, right? So this is a in terms of access to food during pandemic, is this, for example, people who are on quarantine or are sick, or what is exactly the project also related to the humanities track?
Sure. So let me talk about the project with the humanities truck. Yes. So that is in partnership with DC Central Kitchen. So DC Central Kitchen is a community-based program that really whose mission is to improve food access for residents in DC. So we've partnered with them on several projects over the past 4 years. And this is a project to connect with them to speak with DC residents, primarily in Ward 7 and 8, where there are food deserts and food swamps, outside of corner store community, outside of corner stores. So there are only three grocery stores in all of Ward 7 and 8. So there's a real lack of access to healthy, nutritious, affordable food. So much of the food purchasing and food choices are made at these small corner stores. And so we're going to be having the humanities truck outside of these corner stores and inviting residents to just talk about their experiences, talk about the challenges, talk about their resilience, just share their stories. And as this is really a community-based project, our hope and intention is that they will have a place and a space to share these stories, and also that we will then go back and share these stories with the community members as well.
You also mentioned the corner stores. This is interesting for many reasons. You know, I come from Europe, and there is this culture of corner stops and where you would meet with friends. But why is it important in terms of access to food? And the corner stores are typically more expensive. Is there a problem with transportation?
Yes, so that's a great question. So these corner stores tend to be sort of, you know, quick, easily accessible packaged food, so mostly like high caloric, you know, dense processed foods. And so what DC Central Kitchen, their program, the Healthy Communities program, or Healthy Corner Stores program, is really a way to put fresh fruits and vegetables and produce into the corner stores so that this can be an option for residents to have affordable access to fruits and vegetables. So traditionally in these corner stores, you're not going to be getting fresh food or nutritious food. It's really going to be prepackaged food.
Oh, that's very interesting. So the idea is to lower the price of healthy food rather than making
That's right.
like organic food being expensive. Does it work? Is there any evidence that it actually changes the behavioral patterns and the customs of the local community?
Yeah, so far I think the, you know, our preliminary data says is promising and says yes, it's working. So we did an evaluation of these corner store programs and we saw some really promising positive results of people's food purchasing behaviors and increases in fruit and vegetable purchases, and also in speaking with residents and their consumption as well. So what we want to do with this new project is talk to residents about any changes or any impacts in their ability to purchase foods from the corner stores, or changes in the types of food that they're purchasing that have been a direct impact of the pandemic. Or, you know, changes in their employment, changes in their housing, you know, changes in their health, all kinds of things that could also be contributing to changes in their behavior. We know that Blacks and Hispanic Americans and people of color are underserved medically. We know that. And as I said earlier, you know, this pandemic is just really reflective of that. And so we're seeing these patterns played out with testing, lag time in results of testing too, which is really interesting. So there was just a large survey that came out, and it had some good news and some not so good news. So the good news is, you know, people, the testing capacity is increasing in this country. Results are getting back sooner than they were in the summer. The bad news is if they're still not accessible to many of those who need testing the most, or that the most vulnerable, and there's still not fast enough help and assistance with contact tracing and quarantining. So, you know, the other two prongs of a widespread testing program. And the even sort of worse news is that Black Americans and other people of color have to wait nearly a day longer for test results than white Americans. So, you know, we see these disparities in testing and in testing results as well.
This is very interesting. How is it even possible? This comes from the provider side, because once you are tested, it's anonymous, I think, like this is de-identified, right? So nobody's
reading. Oh, yeah. So it's not on an individual level. No, this issue isn't on an individual level. It's on a community level of how, you know, so the, you know, this is a patchwork. Our testing system right now is not national and not a national system. It's not a coordinated system. It's very much dependent on where you live and how, you know, available and widespread those the testing is, and whether you're getting it through your insurance or not, or how you pay for it, or if it's out of pocket. So this is all very much, you know, depends on where you are and what's going on in that community. And because there's been huge problems with our testing capacity and being able to ramp them up. So yeah, so it's not an individual problem. It's a it's the fact that, you know, many Black and Hispanic Americans and other low-income Americans are living in communities and in neighborhoods where there just isn't widespread testing capacity.
So basically, if they wanted to get tested, they will wait in a longer lines, and then they wait longer for the results, which is essential in this case, because
that's right.
If you, it basically destroys the idea of contact tracing, because if
that's
you have
right.
contact tracing after 7 days, then
it's
you
useless.
Don't need to do that.
That's right. Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So it was very interesting what you were saying about the food projects. And also, I think it might be interesting from the perspective of how the community gathers together, especially in the times of COVID. If you right now go to a large mall, it's actually more risky. You're meeting more people. I'm not sure if it's true. You can say if it's not true. But it looks like staying in a smaller community right now, supporting each other, going to a corner store shop might be a safer way of acquiring food. But there is still a risk of infection. And my understanding is that John actually works on a solution which would help with it. Is that right, John? Because my understanding is that you are working on tests for surfaces, not for people.
My research is on genomics. And so I've been interested in how you can do rapid genomic tests for pathogens for some time. So when the COVID crisis came along, this seemed like a great opportunity to extend what I was working on. And the technique that we've been using, actually we've been using several, they're called isothermal DNA amplification techniques. They're like PCR, but it's a family of techniques that actually don't require fancy equipment. So they operate actually quicker than PCR, but with similar sort of sensitivities and other parameters to PCR. And so that's their nucleic acid amplification, where if you amplify the material, you've detected it. And then the readout has to be some detector of the amplified material, and that can happen in several different ways. We've been working with, actually it's a lateral flow strip that looks like a pregnancy test readout. So it gives you one band for negative, two bands for a positive, which is kind of nice. But there's other things, you can actually do them with colorimetric as well. So the technology that we've been using recently, actually there's two of them, one called recombinase polymerase assay, and one called loop-mediated isothermal amplification, or LAMP. So RPA and LAMP, they're two different isothermal methods that we've tried and we've been playing with in my lab, and they're very promising. So we didn't invent these technologies. What we're trying to do is put them into a cartridge device that could be taken to the corner store for example, if you're concerned that there's COVID spread in that community, you could take the device to the site where you think spread is happening, swab a surface, and check to see if the virus is there. Or let's say you're on a college campus and you want to know if a dorm has infection, you could swab the door handle of a dorm, right, or other buildings. And it's a way of surveilling the environment naturally and trying to identify the virus in the environment. Because right now, people are focused on the virus in people, but people are getting infected somewhere. And we have some ideas, but it really is a mysterious process to some extent. So if we had a better sense for where is this virus residing, not that surfaces are infectious. We don't think surfaces are particularly infectious. We think that the infectious source is usually a person. A person speaking to another person is probably where this happens from all the data that we have. Masks are very effective at blocking transmission, but surfaces may sometimes be infectious sources as well. You'd want to be careful with that. The data, again, is a little unclear. But again, we see a surface as a way to track the infection in the environment itself. And that's an area that's kind of been under studied, I think.
Yeah, this is absolutely fascinating. First of all, the process itself, maybe you can describe it a little bit. I am a bit familiar, and I don't think that most of the audience is familiar with the PCR. This was a Nobel Prize winning technique, right, if I remember correctly, which basically the idea is that you have a small amount of DNA or RNA, and you wouldn't be able to detect it in this amount, but you can amplify it quickly, 30,
right.
40 times.
Exactly,
and then
right.
The amount of them is good enough to be detected by a simple method. So I know about this one. I never heard about the other two techniques.
So let me just back up a second. So PCR has a process of cycling. So first you have to, DNA is a double-stranded molecule. You have to heat it up. You melt the strands apart. Then some primers, which are short pieces of DNA, have to bind and anneal. And then they have to be extended by a polymerase enzyme. It's essentially what the cell does, but you're doing it in a test tube with things that you put in there, right? So the detection happens in a machine that has to repeatedly heat and cool and then do that over and over again. It's an exponential amplification because every cycle you double the amount of DNA. Okay, so that makes sense. When I first read about isothermal amplification, I thought there's no way this could work, right? How do you get the DNA to denature without heating the block? And the answer to that question is you use what the cell does. The cell manages to copy DNA without a heat block, right? We don't have to heat up to copy our own DNA. There are proteins that do that. So what scientists figured out is you can put those proteins into the test tube along with the polymerase, and it works the way your cell does, actually. It's pretty ingenious. A lot of times these proteins are from bacteria, not from humans. There's also some different tricks that they do. So for example, LAMP is similar to RPA. They both kind of are similar in certain ways. They both use the proteins from the cell. You use the process of making a strand of DNA to bump off the strand you just made. So it's actually a displacement that happens, and that's how you separate DNA. So there's some tricks, there's molecular tricks that we use. The bottom line, and what's really cool about these techniques, is they run at the speed of the molecule. You're not tied in to how long it takes you to heat the sample and cool the sample, and everything proceeds in lockstep. Instead, everything is chaotic in there. You just put everything in the tube, and it goes as fast as it wants to go, right? Until you run out of reagent, which is what makes it actually faster. And I was skeptical when I first was reading about these. I thought, this is crazy, crazy stuff. It works, and it works really well. And there's hundreds, actually, LAMP itself has 3,000 papers since its discovery in 2001, I think it was first discovered. So it's been around for over 20 years, or about 20 years now.
You know, it's interesting. I really think the future of our response, response to this pandemic is really in antigen testing. You know, the ability to expand capacity and the speed of communicating results is just, really the only way to make a significant contribution to where we are now, And I think rapid testing, whether we're talking about surface or in humans, is going to be a really critical tool in our toolbox to, to mitigate this community spread. We're just caught in this limbo right now.
I read, I'm following a MedCram YouTube videos. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're very high quality health information about COVID, as opposed to most of the information about COVID out there. I know about it because my wife is in exactly like Melissa in medical field. She works at IRB administrator at George Washington for medical research. So she directed me to this, and I heard there very interesting things about the difference between applying, let's say, PCR method with high sensitivity and in relatively expensive process and lengthy process as compared to doing a rapid testing, which might have a lower sensitivity and susceptibility, but that's okay because we are doing a lot of testing. So you get a population information much faster. So your solution, John, it seems like it would be something which would go this way, but interestingly, not on for people testing, but for the environment testing, which is even less invasive because we don't need to be tested personally. We can test the environment. If there is a virus in the environment, then there is a risk of infection because somebody spread that virus, right? So that would be the logic behind it.
And I think Melissa brought up the issue of then contact tracing, and there are interesting technological ways to try to figure out both who might be in the vicinity and might have deposited the virus and who might have contracted it from them. So those are, you know, there are different ways that people could be thinking about that. And we haven't even begun, like that's kind of the beyond, we're kind of focused on just the cartridge that we would use.
But that seems like it should be done in parallel, and since it's not expensive, why is it not done on a regular basis? Like why there is no daily swaps at American University everywhere quickly for a few dollars, maybe a little bit more than that?
The technology doesn't exist for point of care, I don't know if you want to call it point of contact. Testing, we talk about point of care for people, but we're not thinking about point of contact for testing a surface for COVID-19 yet.
So this is, it's just experimental technology. It's not
yet experimental. Commercialized. It's one of the things. So like I said, the techniques are there, and there's dozens of papers specifically applying LAMP to SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. But this technology has not been built into a cartridge that you can buy somewhere and take to a surface. There are companies that are exploring some of these types of things, but they're mostly focused on doing it for people who might be carrying the virus. And that is kind of the big brass ring that companies are going for. And that's, in some ways, that's easier because people shed millions of viruses per mil in their saliva, for example. So if you want to detect the virus, saliva is an easy source, but you got to do that in a medical center. You've got to have personnel. You're not going to do that out in the field, in essence. We're kind of interested in what can you take out into the field to give you some insight into the spread in the environment. Mm-hmm. Is SARS-CoV-2 hanging out in the grocery store? Mm-hmm. Is it hanging out in the corner store? Is it somewhere else? And then how is it getting to those places? I think there's a lot of interesting questions. We haven't really scratched the surface on those.
This has an interesting relation to privacy, right? Like if you wanted to swipe a class to see whether there somebody might be infected and you don't want to invade the privacy of that person, you might just swap a class and you know that somebody was infected, and then you maybe do the remote class because of that, right?
I can tell you, if that happened, you would want to notify everyone in that classroom to go get a PCR follow-up at Student Health Center, right? So you would not change what they do. You would use it to funnel people. Surveillance is used to shunt people into the traditional diagnostic methods.
Sort of the same way we're seeing with testing water sources too, and we're seeing that as a strategy being used in, you know, in some universities where they can then, you know, find evidence of the virus in the water, and then, you know, as John pointed out, then everyone that's in that dorm is then notified, you need to go get tested now.
Yes, that's very interesting. It also addresses indirectly the problem of equity in access to tests, because if you could put the burden of testing onto the community management, for example, then you don't force people who, for example, might not have a full coverage to pay for test immediately, but only when it's necessary. Right? So you don't need to test that often. If you cannot detect a testing environment, maybe you wouldn't need to go test yourself very often, like we are supposed to do before going to university and so on, right?
Yes, and we don't have a comprehensive national testing strategy in this country. And so, to your point, if we did, that could be a strategy that would explicitly address some of these disparities and would allow for coordination between the federal, state, and local governments, as well as the private sector. And that just simply doesn't exist right now. And because of that lack of timely and quick response and preparedness, you could argue, because of that at the beginning, exactly what you're saying, we've been playing catch up for, you know, ever since then. We've been playing catch up with our testing, we've been playing catch up with the data to try to understand spread, you know, and we've just been playing catch up for the past 8 months.
Surveillance testing is really important for universities to reopen safely. That's been one of the things we've learned from
a
number of reopenings that succeeded and a number that did not succeed. Rapid and repeated testing of the population is critical. And it's a best practice, really. And what's interesting is, and there's a lot of discussion going on right now about sensitivity versus speed. And the issue with PCR is extremely sensitive, but that delay, even 24 hours or a 48-hour delay, is really a problem. You actually need that result same day if possible. And if you can do it in a few hours or even minutes, even better. So there's this discussion, Melissa brought it up, with antigen testing now. They're less sensitive, but they give a result in 15 minutes, and you can do them like 3 times a week. So that actually does better on a population level than PCR, even if you tested by PCR and you had 3 times a week and you had that 2-a-day delay. For us, it's 48 hours right now at AU to get our results back. And that's actually been a little longer than that for some. And that's just killer.
And that's with what? That's with 200 on average a week. Isn't that about what we're doing? Yeah.
And if you,
so if you think
that,
about if you scale that up to, you know, our student population, we can't handle it right now.
So the issue is, during that delay, you don't know who has the virus, and they're going to be spreading it around, right? So what you have to do is catch the highly infectious individuals that day and pull them out of the population. Antigen testing will catch the most infectious individuals right away. You remove them from the population, you're better off overall, even though those lower level individuals sneak past, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea is, the lower level individuals will, they're at early in the infection cycle, they will rise. So if you're testing every 2 days, you'll catch them the next time round.
That's right.
Right?
So
you're trading off sensitivity and speed. Overall, speed wins.
That's right. That's right. Right now, that's exactly right. It's a balance between accuracy and lag time and results. And So, I mean, I just want to underscore what John's saying on the testing, absolutely, and just add the other, you know, two components to a rigorous testing program, which is also the ability to, you know, isolate and contact trace as well. And just giving, you know, a shout out to, you know, testing and our ability and the science that allows us to detect through these tests is what is a modern public health approach to a pandemic or an outbreak. The other things that are incumbent upon us as individuals that work, mask wearing, social distancing, and frequent hand washing, these are tools that we've had for 100 years, and they work then, and they work very well. But those are the only tools we had in 1980. For the influenza pandemic. Now here we have what could be really another really critical tool in our toolkit. And it's just being underutilized now for lots of reasons.
Yes, it's interesting what you said. In the influenza pandemic, there was no DNA known, right? This DNA is discoveries after that. So we have now an exact information about this virus directly available, including the whole sequence in early January. And everybody knew it will happen. It was obvious from the Chinese population. And yet, 9 months later, it's still not a systemic approach. It's very, very surprising. And it's not only in the US. It's all over the world. There is really almost no example which we can give where the pandemic is handled really well, unless you have an example. Maybe you can.
I would say New Zealand has been sort of a superstar in terms of the response. You know, they've had fluctuations. At one point over the summer, they were, you know, basically had eliminated COVID-19. But you know, if you think about what they did, they had a decisive and quick and coordinated government response with effective communication and consistent communication. They had high compliance from the population. They very quickly ramped up their testing capacity to, you know, as John was talking, to be able to identify transmission chains early and then isolate and limit further spread. Their contact tracing program was very, very rigorous. And so, you know, I would say New Zealand is a great example of a lockdown and a response that was really stringent and brief and worked. And and even if we're looking at, you know, what have we learned from the 1918, you know, pandemic, the largest pandemic in our world, responsible for, you know, upwards of 50 million deaths, there are a lot of similarities. And if we look at sort of just key lessons from that, you know, pandemic that really ravaged, civilization, it was respond early, relax cautiously, and tell people the truth. There are a lot of similarities in terms, in this country, in terms of the government leadership and response.
I think we should start to wrap it up. It's very interesting, and your research is really important. So it's fascinating that American University is doing that. I hope, John, that you will get an investor for your project or funding for your project. As we discussed earlier, it would be, I think it's an essential project. And Melissa, your work with food sounds like a not only pandemic time, but in general, very important project. So thank you very much for sharing this.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you for your time. Thank you. This was a lot of fun.